Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hi, I'm Donna Bridges, Associate Professor of Sociology at Charles Sturt University. Today we delve into a pressing issue that continues to affect countless lives, gendered violence. Despite national efforts to eradicate this problem within a generation, recent statistics indicate a troubling escalation. Joining us to explore this critical topic is Jess Hill, an investigative journalist renowned for her in-depth reporting on domestic abuse and coercive control. Jess is the author of an acclaimed book, See What You Made Me Do, and the recent quarterly essay titled Losing It, Can We Stop Violence Against Women and Children? Her work has earned her prestigious accolades, including the Walkley Award, well, I think plural, Walkley Awards, the Stella Prize, and recognition as New South Wales Premier Woman of Excellence in 2024. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jess. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Donna.
Jess, in your quarterly essay, Losing It, you highlight that despite governmental promises, gendered violence is escalating. You also say that you need to be clear that governments are responding to the problem in various ways. But could you elaborate on the key factors contributing to the increase of gendered violence?
So I guess just to step it back, and when I say that we have gendered violence that's increasing, let's identify what we know about that. So what we know is that sexual violence is increasing and it's changing. We not only have increases in actual sexual violence and sadly a decrease in the percentage of victim survivors willing to report from 13% in 2016 to 8% in 2021. But we also have an increase in the types of non-physical coercive control behaviours, particularly surveillance and using tech-facilitated abuse, essentially. So we saw that 200,000 person increase since the 2016 personal safety survey of women who say they've been stalked via technology by an ex-partner. The recent data from the child maltreatment study showing that the most common type of child sex offender is no longer an adult, but another adolescent who is known to the child or the person under 18. That has been a marked increase in the amount of sexual offending by adolescents, while we've seen child sex abuse by adults decrease. And we've also seen institutional child sex abuse decrease as well. There are examples that we could be looking to where we have achieved quite substantial reduction. Is there anything we can learn from that? I think also when we talk about increases in gender-based violence, we obviously had a spike in domestic homicides of about 30%. We don't know why that happened. We don't know if it will repeat or if it's a one-off. They also surveyed on intimate partner violence in teenagers, and apparently the results from that are quite shocking. This is the generation that should be showing the benefits of a national plan that's now been in place for 15 years. It should be showing the benefits of increased education around this for young people. And also where we have had a nationally coordinated plan for the first time in Australia's history and unusually across the world to respond to and to prevent gender-based violence. That's where I think we should be placing more focus. Why aren't we seeing greater reductions, particularly in sexual violence perpetration, but also in intimate partner violence and coercive control?
I certainly remember when it was a radical idea that an unequal society created violence. So if we had gender inequality in different parts of society, the violence against women would be increased. And we did see more inequality occur in Australia in recent times. So as far as the global estimates, we were going down. Would that contribute, do you think?
It's really hard to say. the gender equality indexes, they measure like particularly structural equality, political representation, certain policies, etc. It doesn't measure statistics around violence. What are the, how do systems respond to that violence? There's a lot that goes unmeasured. I don't think it's good that we were slipping backwards. I think, we want to be measuring high on those structural measures. I'm not sure that it was fundamental to the steady rates of violence, particularly among young people. And the reason why I say that is because of what we call the Nordic paradox, in which the Nordic countries, which, have the types of gender equality rates, structurally, and I would say also on an attitudinal level, that really Australia at this point could only dream of. Those countries are as close to gender equal utopias as we have in the world right now, and yet that they have higher than average rates of gendered violence. So, for example, Spain has its rates of violence are about 13%. 13% of women having experienced physical or sexual violence since around the age of 15. In Sweden, Norway, Finland, Iceland, it's all hovers around 28%, 28 to 30%. In Australia, we have our statistics being 1 in 4, so around 25%. So I think there's still some really unanswered questions. There's lots of theories, like is it backlash? Is it not in those Nordic countries? There's not a lot of sunlight for periods of the year. Some heavy drinking cultures. I mean, there's all sorts of theories, but no one has actually landed on a convincing explanation. And why is it that in a country like Spain, which is perhaps pretty macho culture, why is Spain doing so much better on gendered violence than Sweden?
And do the rates of men committing acts of violence against men have a relationship?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure. So if you could do some research into that, Donna,
Yeah.
that'd be great.
Okay.
The one area where we've seen a reduction in Australia, we've seen a reduction in physical violence. So the physical violence from men to women has reduced since around 2005, but we've also seen a reduction in male-on-male physical violence. So it seems to be a reduction in physical violence across the board. I'd love to hear more about that. That's something I haven't had a chance to ask people questions about.
And also, are those reductions that we're seeing at the moment statistically significant because they've been around for long enough? So we have to watch that space. And what you've been saying, I think, leads quite nicely into my next question, which is about coercive control. Now, you said in your essay that to date you have decoded coercive control for audiences at almost 400 events across Australia. Can you do that for our listeners now? What is coercive control? How has it been legislated? And what does it mean for us in Australian society?
Sure. Coercive control essentially is a pattern of coercive domination and subordination exerted by one person or a group of people against another person or a group of people. Now, in intimate partner violence, it's usually one person over an intimate partner, and if there's children involved, the children too. In group scenarios, we see coercive control used in cults, but also in some families where there's extended kin networks, where you may have the husband and wife living together under the husband's family with the husband's family, you may have coercive control being perpetrated by the mother-in-law against the daughter-in-law. You may also have coercive control being exerted by adult children against their elderly parents. The key here is about being able to establish a power imbalance, in which one person is able to establish power and dominance over another using a lot of coercive means and using a process of what we call thought reform. It's what people used to call brainwashing, right? And it's why a lot of people who go through coercive control will say the overarching feeling is can be confusion, can be anger, can be a feeling I don't know myself anymore. I don't recognize myself when I look in the mirror. I do and think things that don't feel like me. And the process by which thought reform occurs is And it's so common and so repetitive in these situations that I called the first chapter in my book The Perpetrator's Handbook, because it literally is when victim survivors get together, they're like, did he study at TAFE? How do they all know how to do this? You know, it's a pattern of breaking someone down and then basically building them up to be what you want them to be, which is subordinate. Tactics and behaviors like isolation, micromanaging, setting really quite random rules and establishing consequences, degradation, an atmosphere of threat, gaslighting, making that person focus on their own flaws and faults as a reason, as a way to explain why the abuse or why the fights are happening, you know.
That's a lot more complex than I realized. And what I'm thinking now is, how do you prove that and how do you control it just in terms of the law?
Chronology that's organized by dates. There may be incidents within coercive control. There may be really extreme incidents, or there may be things like property damage, or there may be things like a really extreme fight that happens in front of, friends or family, or there may be threats made over text, or, as we've seen increasingly over, online banking transactions, or there may be physical and sexual violence. There may be child abuse. There's so many things that are tangible that happen within coercive control. If you chunk it out piece by piece, were you isolated from friends and family? How did they isolate you? Did they isolate you by saying you could not go out or there'd be consequences? Because that does happen. Like, did they say they would really prefer you not to speak to friends and family because they think that they're bad for you? Did they seem to always have a problem when you wanted to go out? Did you start to withdraw from social interaction because it just became too hard and your partner made it hard for you? When people start writing down these behaviors and start showing the accumulation of behaviors, that's when the whole web of coercive control becomes clear. And they leave a trail. Sometimes they leave a financial abuse trail in the sense that they're like only giving you a certain amount of money. It may be that they've messaged you 400 times in a day with like really, threatening and abusive messages. There's often a trail. When I was first researching this and, thinking about advocacy here in Australia, I spoke to a specialist prosecutor in Scotland about, well, how do you prove this? And as far as they were concerned, proving this course of conduct was actually much easier than proving something like an incident-based charge. In terms of being able to show who's the primary aggressor, you can have a woman who has used violence against their partner as an act of resistance, as an act of self-defense. But because there's no the other evidence about what she was subjected to is not relevant for that charge. The charge is about whether you did or did not use violence against your partner. That's a disaster. Because a lot of women will use violence because literally they are being subjected to a form of torture. So when the extenuating circumstances for why that violence was used and the context is irrelevant to the court, that is extraordinarily dangerous. And that's why I advocated for coercive control laws, because actually where we've seen them put into place, we've seen misidentification percentages go down.
That is complex, and I think from listening to you, that for some people, being able to document that and make a list of all the things that are going on would be enough to make them realize, well, hey, I am in a domestic violence situation. I might not be being hit, because some people get quite confused around that. Well, he's never hit me, but I feel like I'm in an abusive situation. But I'm told by others, well, he doesn't hit you. I'm told that by him. It could clarify things. Let's clarify things about First Nations women and children and violence, which you do talk about in the quarterly essay. I think a lot of people think that perhaps First Nations gendered violence is a First Nations issue, but you had other things to say in the quarterly essay. So could you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is there's statistics that come from all across the country, but let's just say, for example, in Victoria, And the Family Violence Legal Service, JIRA, which is run by Antoinette Braybrook, they say, the vast majority of their client, their Aboriginal female clients are partnered with non-Aboriginal men. And this you see really across the country. And I remember sitting in at the Safe Steps Family Violence Crisis Line, and they said that one of the most common calls they would have is from Aboriginal women who are being absolutely tormented by a current or former partner who is non-Aboriginal. And the power differential there in terms of the sorts of threats that can be made about child removal and all of that is, like, truly terrifying. I mean, I've heard this all around the country, anecdotally, from Alice Springs to Darwin to, where Aboriginal women can be subject to these abusive regimes, even by men who have quite good standing in the community, who may even be working in social services. In the case of one woman who stood up and told her absolutely terrifying story of years of being tormented by this person who was otherwise had a great reputation, a non-Aboriginal man. And the trap that sets for them is just is next level, especially when you're thinking about barriers to wanting to report to any type of service for an Aboriginal woman for all of the obvious reasons in terms of the sorts of racism that they may experience when they do. But child protection and that threat of child removal is, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of First Nations women, but certainly you hear that that's one of the most potent threats that can be leveled. And what I talk about in the quarterly essay is what Aboriginal advocates have been talking about for decades and has only gotten worse over time, where child removal rates are just at the almost at the highest they've been in a very long time, to the point where we're talking about a second stolen generation. Now, that's not because just because the situation for those children has become so untenable in their homes that they have no choice but to be removed. But in so many instances, you're seeing removal that is totally avoidable, were it just for some, a little bit of extra intervention, early intervention or support. And also, there are so many instances where a perpetrator's word has been taken verbatim by child protection, like, she drinks or she neglects the children without the requisite investigation. There's one, I mean, there's one case study I mentioned in the quarterly that's particularly galling, but one of them was a woman who had called child protection because she was concerned about the danger posed by her, I think it was her ex-partner, towards her kids. Child protection arrived. The ex-partner was abusing her, was being abusive towards the children. And then later he said, well, she's a drinker. And child protection turned on a dime from assisting her to announcing that they were going to remove the children. And once that child removal has been enacted, it is so difficult to get those children back. I do not understand why we are not investing in support, particularly for Aboriginal women who've experienced gendered violence. There are so many things we could do that would be so much cheaper than removing a child, so much more effective, and not setting up a situation where you see, a reasonable percentage of those kids who go into out-of-home care crossing over into engaging with youth detention, so much that they call them the crossover cohort. It's a mad way of managing this situation, and I think as a systemic response, totally broken.
Let's talk about children then. It sounded like in the quarterly essay that children are often lost in these conversations. And you've talked extensively about societal perceptions that violent perpetrators should have easy access to their children. And you've talked about the dangers of this. Could you tell us a bit more about this problem?
I want to talk just briefly about Professor Marianne Hester's three planets idea, which is there's the domestic abuse planet where services and potentially police, I mean, obviously not always perfectly, as we know, but services and response systems will kick into gear. They acknowledge this perpetrator is violent. We need to protect this woman and children. We might be able to get her into refuge. We might be, all this. So there's this whole ecosystem in the domestic abuse planet that says you need protection from this man. Then you go to the Child Protection Planet, and remember, when victim survivors, especially when they're thinking about leaving, or they've come to the attention of authorities, can be existing on all three planets at the one time. The Child Protection Planet is one where if you're not protecting your child, no matter what the violent person is doing, it's your responsibility to protect your children. We don't really engage the violent person because it's too difficult, and they're not going to take responsibility anyway. So the responsibility is all on you. And if you fail to protect them, then your children may be removed. Then you go to the Family Court Planet, and the Family Court Planet says what happened between you and your partner was the violence between you. That really shouldn't concern your children. What happens now is that you should be bigger, that you shouldn't hold on to grievances, and you should do whatever you can to facilitate contact between your children and your ex-partner. So if you are living on all three planets at once, you are getting completely contradictory information and instructions such that it actually starts to make victim survivors and their children feel like they're losing their minds. One of the stories was about Teresa being the victim survivor mother, Jack being her son, and there were two other siblings. His father, Jack's father, liked to call himself Ivan because he admired the serial killer Ivan Milat. I think that's all you probably need to know about what growing up with that man was like. They managed to escape this man. Then they went through the process of getting him charged with a charge sheet that is just as long as your arm, or use of weapons, just everything. So then they're at the court. Teresa gets followed home by her ex-husband's lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, to her safe house, which should be secret, and served family court papers detailing his parents' claim to custody to her children. So they are initiating family court proceedings alleging that she has been abusive towards her children. So that family were not only dealing with family court and police and the court and the criminal courts, but also dealing with child protection workers coming in and think and seeing Teresa as the person who was at fault. She was mandated to do a parenting program, forced to write an apology letter to her own children. She refused, but she was asked to write an apology letter to her ex-husband by child protection. At the very time when they should have been recovering and reestablishing their life, instead, they spent years under threat from various systems, under threat of being removed. Even after he was jailed, this process continued. She got full custody. She got an apology from child protection. This is all avoidable. This is violence that was experienced after they left, and it was perpetuated by systems.
It sounds phenomenal. I can't believe it. But we're coming to you today from the Central West. So we're regional, we're rural. Do you know anything about how gendered violence in rural areas is nuanced, is different?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are many, many nuances. So I'll just pick up on a few. One key nuance is you are further away from help. Now, that makes a difference in terms of the harm you may experience if you are physically or sexually attacked. It makes a difference in terms of whether you feel able to report, especially because people you're reporting to may be known to your family, may be known to the person you're reporting about. So there are real constraints on getting help. There's also, when we're not paying a lot of attention to this, but we're hearing much more about the use of weapons, and that, we sort of thought we'd dealt with guns, with the Howard reforms, but actually there's been a real rise in gun use and ownership. And of course, in rural areas, on farms and all the rest of it, obviously guns are permitted, but the presence of guns in rural areas complicates things and makes the likelihood of harm much more severe. There are so many different things that make it much harder. I think also for young victim survivors, I spoke to Connor Paul, who is a youth advocate, a youth survivor advocate in Victoria, and he grew up in Mildura on the border of New South Wales and Victoria. And his experience disclosing to his school was not a positive one. Partly a lot of that is around is the perpetrator known to the person you're disclosing to? And what is the perpetrator's reputation locally? That there can be, it can be a lot harder to be believed. You can't, it's a lot harder to be anonymous. It's a lot harder to escape. It's a lot harder to seek help. You know, it's a lot harder to get support, the sort of support that you might need, even if you plan to stay in the relationship, just the mental health support that you might need to achieve some kind of clarity. We know that the prevalence is higher in rural and regional areas. That's, we know that. And I don't think that we as a nation have really thought about how that should be reflected in funding allocation.
Yeah, we certainly do know that it's harder to get services out here. And also, we do have old white guys who are in charge of things, and what they might prioritize as being necessary for the community might be different to what women would prioritize were they given decision-making power. Well, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it. I know that our listeners are going to really enjoy listening, and we'll learn a great deal from you. I know I did. So thanks, Jess. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm now joined by my colleagues, Clifford Lewis and Sonia Maria. Well, wasn't that a fantastic interview? I feel like I learned a lot about coercive control. I was introduced to some statistics around young people that I found surprising. What surprised you? What do you think is the take-home message about the show?
What I found really interesting is the conversation about it's hard to show who the primary aggressor is, drawing on that model of, to have a police complaint, you need to have evidence, and evidence can sometimes be staged as well, depending on people's situations and realities. But what that also made me think about is, well, what supports are available to reach out so they're not isolating themselves and they're able to gain that support? And also, perhaps listening to what those we love and care about, whose opinions matter to us, are saying. I think usually those outside are in a better position to see things more clearly, but we are so defensive to protect our partner. I've done that. We're so defensive at protecting our partner that we wouldn't mind cutting off relationships instead of pondering what are they trying to say to us and why might that be? Which can be quite confronting an exercise as well.
That's right. If everybody else has got a problem with your partner and you're also struggling, it might be a good idea to educate yourself about what's going on in the relationship. Maybe there is a problem, maybe there's not, but if you at least engage in that level of education, you might be able to ascertain whether it or not it is a problem. Well, thank you for being with us today. And next month we have Sonia talking about.
We're talking about a research project on getting PrEP, which is a drug that is used to prevent the spread of HIV, young people using it in rural areas, and what are their barriers?
Thanks, Sonia. We look forward to it.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.